This is Mark Strassman, reporter with California Politics Today. We're about to speak to Susan Kennedy, who's one of the commissioners on the California Public Utilities Commission. Welcome back to California Politics Today.
Thank you, Mark. It's great to be here.
The last time we spoke, you said it was a crime that there was no major broadband over power line trial going on in California. You got some flack from the amateur radio operators about that. Is that crime still going on, and do you see any chance of mitigating it?
Well, since we made a big deal out of the fact that California was being left behind, our three utilities have all been very aggressive at trying to rectify the situation. San Diego Gas and Electric has already announced a pilot project they're engaging in, and I've met with the leadership of both Southern California Edison and Pacific Gas and Electric, and they're both all three are very seriously looking at and trying to launch pilot projects.
Okay, now it's not the focus of this conversation, but if you could just say a word or two about the ongoing national and in several local sites as well, controversy about whether a BPL through radio frequency interference is a serious impediment to amateur radio operators, and how you feel that issue might be resolved in California if it arose here.
Well, I think it's a serious concern. Because under certain conditions, I believe it can interfere. But I don't believe that those concerns or those problems are insurmountable. I've seen test studies done where any interference is very minimal or non-existent, unless you're somehow sitting 14 inches from the pole.
Right.
This is not an insurmountable problem, and I believe that the FCC, I know, is taking it quite seriously, and they'll address this issue.
Would the PUC, California PUC, have any role in that, or would it would only be between the utilities and the companies and the FCC to decide about it?
Oh, I believe this will be a federal issue. This is about radio frequency standards and stuff. So.
Okay. Well, in fact, that's what we're going to talk about mostly right now, that the FCC's jurisdiction. Could you tell our listeners what the position of the FCC is on the regulation of voice over IP service?
Well, based upon the decisions that I've seen so far, the FCC has occupied the field and said that it should not be, these new technologies like VoIP should not be subject to the traditional patchwork of state-by-state regulations.
And what kind of federal regulation, if any, should they be subject to, according to the FCC?
They have not indicated that yet. There are open proceedings at which they'll have to address each of the issues that, a lot of the issues that have been raised, like whether or not they would be required to pay access charges, whether or not they would be required to contribute to universal service, how and when they'd be required to comply with 911, E911 obligations, and all of those will be addressed in open proceedings.
So, and what's the timetable for that, as far as you know?
Well, some of the proceedings are open, and as you know, that there's been some changeover at the FCC, and
right,
there's more changeover to come, and so I imagine that's going to slow them down a little in terms of addressing some of these issues. But, you know, the IP-enabled services proceeding, which is one of the key ones, is an open docket right now. Comments have already been filed. You know, I don't think it's going to be a very long time before we see some movement on some key issues. But basically, what the FCC did was say, he told states, don't try to occupy the field. All it did was put a red light up for states,
right,
so that we don't all try and solve these problems on a 50-state patchwork basis.
Does that mean that right now voice over IP service isn't regulated by anyone?
Well, it's not regulated in the traditional sense, but
right,
that does not mean that they're not subject to the same laws and regulations that protect consumers and guide a lot of the industry interactions. I mean, if a VoIP provider like Vonage or 8x8 wants to get numbers from the North American numbering plan, they got to go through the same process as any other provider that wants to use those numbers. Vonage is being sued for in Texas because the AG says they didn't disclose 911 capabilities, their lack of 911 capabilities being the same as a traditional phone. So they're not allowed to engage in fraud. They're not allowed to engage in deceptive marketing. It doesn't matter if they're selling baby diapers or if they're selling voice service. They're subject to the same consumer protection laws, just not the same traditional regulation of the incumbent phone company.
Okay. What previously to the actions that were just taken was the position of the California Public Utilities Commission on this question of whether the FCC ought to be in control of deciding about voice over IP regulations?
Well, California has been, in recent years, one of the most aggressive states in taking the position that it's always better for the states to have jurisdiction. And you know, we don't want to give up jurisdiction. The states do it better.
Right.
And so we took the we were one of the first states, if not the first state, to appeal the FCC's decision in the Vonage case, and by saying, you know, a duck is a duck, basically. It doesn't matter what tool you're using to make a phone call. We should be able to apply the same regulations, whether it's a VoIP provider or a baby bell.
And about when did the California PUC take that position?
It was very late last year. As a matter of fact, it was one of the, I think it might have been the last meeting of the year.
Okay, and in 2004. And what did it say it wanted to do?
It said that there was an open proceeding at the FCC,
right,
where the VoIP provider was saying, "Do not subject us to state by state regulation," and
right,
and we filed an appeal to the Vonage decision that said, "No, we want that overturned, and we want to have states to retain the jurisdiction to regulate these providers like we regulate other providers."
Okay, it's been the position, obviously, then of the VoIP providers that they wanted to be federally controlled, not on a state by state basis. That was
most certainly. But beyond that, the only tools we have are tools that were designed for Ma Bell.
Right.
So they're saying two things. They're saying, A, don't subject us to these regulations. We're not a monopoly. We're a competitive product, and we shouldn't be subject to these. And second of all, don't subject something like this to that runs across state lines, travels over the internet, travels internationally. Don't try and subject us to state by state regulation.
Okay, and the FCC concurred in that part of it, then, didn't it?
Yes, in that part of it, that it should not be subject to state by state regulation.
And it's still conducting proceedings to decide whether it ought to be regulated as the other carriers are.
How it should
be regulated.
And how it should interact with important public policy goals like universal service and 911.
Okay. Now, the pending litigation that emerged out of the California Public Utilities Commission position, what was that? Were there current court cases beyond what's in the FCC?
No, after the FCC issued the decision in Vonage where they said states can't regulate using their tools,
right,
we appealed it.
Okay.
We went into court to try and overturn the FCC.
Where'd you go into court? Federal court?
Ninth Circuit.
Ninth Circuit.
Federal court.
And what did they say?
Well, the case has not been ruled on yet.
Okay.
There's several other states that are involved. I think Minnesota. I can't remember if it's.
Okay. And so the decision that the PUC just made was to essentially switch sides in the case that it was bringing in the Ninth Circuit against the FCC decision.
We withdrew our legal challenge.
Okay. Did you? And does that mean the case ended?
No, it means that California won't be one of the states challenging it. So there are other states that have filed appeals, like
New
York.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So the case may stay in the Ninth Circuit, or it may move to another circuit because California is not no longer a party.
Which other states were parties?
I know New York was, and I believe it was I think it was Minnesota.
Okay, and though and
Minnesota was the original state that attempted to regulate Vonage, which sparked the case.
Okay, and in fact, then New York, Minnesota, and California were all suing the FCC in federal court in California.
No, that we all filed in federal court in our various districts.
Oh, okay. So was the case being, had it been consolidated? Was it being heard in one?
It was in the process of being consolidated in the Ninth Circuit.
Oh, okay. So now it's not going to be consolidated in the Ninth Circuit.
Well, I don't know.
It might be.
They went pretty far down the path of consolidating it. I think almost all the other courts had transferred to the Ninth Circuit, so it may actually stay there, but I don't know the process.
But California will no longer be a party to the suit.
Correct.
Did you go the other way and file an amicus brief on the other side?
We have not yet filed an amicus brief on the other side because you can't file anything until we get a brief. You know, we know which court to file in, and they set a briefing schedule.
Okay. Would you like to see see California file an amicus brief on behalf of the FCC?
Yes, I would, and I would also like to see us weigh in on the open proceeding at the FCC called the IP-enabled services proceeding, which basically, deals with some of the same issues. And we can do that before we have to, before the briefing schedule in the Vonage case. So there's several places where we can weigh in and articulate a position that is that supports keeping, you know, old regulations off these new technologies.
Okay. What was the vote in the PUC? Can you talk about that?
It was in executive session where we usually deal with litigation stuff, and so I'm really not supposed to talk about what happened.
Can you talk about what the competing arguments were, some of which may have taken place outside of that executive session?
Yeah, I think they have taken place outside of executive session. So, I mean, the competing arguments are, they kind of run into two tracks. The one is, if you're gonna, the only way to retain any jurisdiction at all, or any way to, you know, have California have control over its own companies, is to litigate. So you just got to fight for jurisdiction, and then we'll discuss the policy implications later.
Right.
That's one approach. Another argument is that if we don't weigh in and kind of nail down our ability to regulate these VoIP providers, these renegade VoIP providers, we're going to destroy the universal service program. We're going to destroy the 911 system because, you know, we don't trust that the FCC is going to make the right decisions. And so, you know, to me, that's kind of a red herring. I mean, everyone knows the universal service system is broken anyway because it's based on taking a percentage of interstate calls.
Right.
And interstate calls are becoming a thing of the past. Now you have cellular, you know, all you can eat cellular plans.
Right.
Where, you know, your local calling plan is from coast to coast. So you don't have the same, you don't have the same long distance service on landlines that you had before, so there's a shrinking amount of money no matter what you do.
So in fact the technology is speeding ahead of the regulation.
Yes, and it won't matter. I mean, we have to change the funding mechanism for universal service, and we have to change the purpose of universal service.
Do you either personally or the commission have proposals in that area yet?
I do, but we haven't.
What would you like to see?
I'd like to see a numbers based system. Let's say California, for example, we have our own universal service fund. It brings in about $1 billion a year.
And what's it levied on now? On these
the
bills of interstate calls.
Yes.
Okay. What you're saying is.
Now, you know, you just tripped me up there. I'm not sure if ours is based on the entire bill or on interstate.
Those bills are pretty complicated, but...
Yeah, but I'm not sure we're allowed to put a fee on an interstate call, so I think it's on the whole bill, but I'll have to get back into that.
Okay.
But its bottom line is it's a percentage based on the customer's bill.
All right.
And if you took that $1 billion and instead applied a per number fee of about $1.50 per number.
For
every number that's assigned to California, which is about 65 million phone numbers.
Right.
You would raise the same $1 billion.
That's $1.50 per number per month.
Yes.
Okay.
That way it doesn't matter if you're a VoIP provider or you're SBC.
Right.
You use a number and you pay into the support for the network.
And what is that universal fund go for now?
It's used to subsidize wireline carriers in the PST and the public switched telephone network in high cost areas like rural areas, mountainous areas, areas where there's, you know, very sparsely populated, and it would be really expensive to bring phone service out there.
Right.
And it's used also to subsidize the phone bills for basic wireline service for low income residents.
And is that done the California Fund only does that within California? Is there any federal participation in this?
Oh yeah, there's a federal program that's universal service, and that California gets about $400 million a year in those funds. There's a state pro. Some states like California have their own program on top of it.
Okay, now you've already said that it's necessary to look at the changing shape of the sources of the money. Should it also be important to look at what the money goes for? In fact, if rather than funding, say, landlines to rural communities where it's more expensive, should there be a consideration of using that money for wireless or Wi-Fi or cellular or WiMAX or other technologies?
My view is we have to relook at what the purpose of universal service is. I mean, this is the, one of the biggest dangers of any kind of a subsidy program is that it once you put in a subsidized program, it never goes away.
And it subsidizes incumbent and legacy and outmoded technology.
Right. If you want to, I mean, everyone screams about why Japan and South Korea and Canada have faster broadband and at, you know, 10 and 20 times or 100 times the speed at lower cost, follow the money. Americans subsidize the old technologies to keep them held harmless with technological change. These countries subsidize new technology.
So it would be like having a buggy whip fund to keep the buggy whip manufacturers in business.
Yep.
So you don't want that.
No, I think there's certainly a role, a very important role for universal service, but we have to be we have to change what it's designed to accomplish in order to allow the customer to choose lower cost technologies and to help these companies that are in these rural areas that have invested so much money in these you know expensive networks to reach sparsely populated areas, help them transition to newer technologies.
What do you think the universal service ought to be providing universally? Broadband connectivity?
You know, I think we should have that discussion. To be honest with you, I think there's two questions here. The universal service program was designed to make sure that everybody had access to lifeline basic phone service.
Right.
When you start then getting into the decision that everybody should have access to broadband and advanced services, then it opens up an entire new can of worms.
Right.
Does that mean everybody should have a laptop with Wi-Fi to it? Does
right.
that mean everybody should have an old, you know, old desktop? Does that mean everybody, you know, you get into questions of you know, what exactly do you mean by broadband?
Right, especially because, though, if everyone had broadband, and we're going to, this is going to circle back to VoIP, if everyone had a broadband connection, then their lifeline phone connection could be provided as VoIP over that broadband connection, couldn't it?
Sure.
Okay, so
but right now we just finished a broadband report on deployment in California,
right.
And it's clear that 90% of the homes in California are passed by cable plant that is modem capable. So right now 90% of the homes in California have access to cable broadband service if they choose to access it.
Okay, let's talk about the migration to voice over IP. What part of voice service that people get in California, if you know, is now provided by voice over IP one way or another?
It's a very small percentage. I think it's probably under 6%.
Do you expect that will grow in the next few years?
No question. There's no question about it.
Is it going to be adopted by the major incumbent telcos as a substitute for the circuit switching they do now?
Absolutely. They're already... there's no question. The circuit switches are 8 to 10 times more expensive than soft switches. You can do a lot more with the space you have when you're transmitting data. It makes absolutely no economic sense whatsoever to maintain a much more costly system for transmitting voice. So and broadband adoption is happening at nearly the pace of Moore's Law itself.
Right.
So it over the next several years. Over the next 5 years, you're going to see a massive migration to IP technologies, and as long as consumers continue to have access to any provider they want for phone service over their internet connection, then I think you're going to see a huge dynamic, very competitive market in terms of VoIP.
Okay. Now, if you put together what you've just said about the evolution of the technology and its wider deployment with your preference and now the preference of the California Public Utilities Commission vis-a-vis regulation from the FCC, are you worried that the FCC might choose to radically deregulate the now or the then voice over IP-based telecommunications system, leading to the demise of universal service or other problems?
No, I'm not. I believe we've been on a track to create to encourage competitive markets for a very, very long time. We're talking decades here.
Right.
Where we protect new technologies for the very purpose of encouraging investment and encouraging innovation. So it's happening. This is what we want. So Ronald Reagan once said, "If it moves, tax it. If it moves, tax it. If it keeps moving, regulate it. If it stops moving, subsidize it.
Okay.
We have to, if you want this stuff to grow and you want it to be affordable and you want consumers to have the choice, then you don't regulate this stuff the way you regulated monopoly technologies. What we need to do is focus on what is the purpose of universal service and fund it in a way that is technology neutral.
Okay. Now, speaking of competition, I did an interview, actually two, with the president of Brand X. Brand X is a small ISP in Santa Monica. They're suing the FCC because the FCC has supported the cable companies' position that offering broadband internet access over a cable line is a information service which is not to be regulated, rather than a telecommunication service which could be. And I'm wondering how that plays into what we've just been talking about, in addition to which you've just said 90% of the homes in California are now cable modem accessible. If the cable companies say voice over IP is great, we're going to provide it over our cable lines, and if you want it, you can buy it from us, and if you don't want it from us, you have to look elsewhere, but we're not going to give anyone access to our cable plant. What's your view on that question?
I think people don't understand what the Brand X case is about.
Okay.
You just really highlighted it. Well, first of all, whether it's an information or telecommunication service is indicative of the problem with the way the statute is written. Is they didn't even contemplate VOIP when they wrote that.
The statute you're referring to is the Telecommunications Reform Act of 1996.
Yeah, there is no difference between telecommunications and information anymore.
Right.
But anybody who can argue that the Internet is not an information service that should not be subject to regulation should have their head examined. But that is not what the Brand X case is about. This is right now. For example, I have Comcast cable,
right.
And I can get on. And I have Earthlink as my internet service provider.
Right.
I also have AOL. We have two at home.
Right.
Nothing stops me from using Earthlink. Comcast has never prevented me. They don't slow anything down. There's no problem. I have no trouble accessing them. And that is so. The status quo allows me to have access to Earthlink. What Earthlink wants is to be able to rent the underlying facility and pay a discounted wholesale price in order to access me directly. Well, that, from the customer's perspective, the difference might be I wouldn't have to pay extra for Earthlink on top of my Comcast broadband.
Well, you'd buy your broadband from Earthlink, not from Comcast.
But Earthlink didn't build the pipe.
No.
Comcast did.
Right.
And so Comcast would be forced to give it to Earthlink as a discount and then sell it to me as if Earthlink owned the pipe.
That's right.
I don't think that's fair. You want to destroy investment in broadband in this country. You know, use that kind of power of eminent domain to take the broadband pipe that was built by tens of billions of dollars, nearly $100 billion in risk capital by the cable companies, and force them to sell it wholesale.
Now, presumably, you feel the same way about the wires that the phone companies own, don't you?
Absolutely. I think it's been for the most part, it's been a failed experiment. The unbundling is not going to now in the enterprise market. It's actually been a very valuable. Very valuable tool to help create competition because of the nature of the enterprise market and the facilities they use. But in the residential market, I think unbundling has been an abject failure.
So does that mean that what you want to see or envision and are working for is that I'm sitting here, I've got SBC is the only phone provider here, and Adelphia, which may be Time Warner pretty soon, is the cable provider. You're saying that I shouldn't, in terms of wired connectivity, my only two choices ought to be to pay Adelphia / Time Warner or SBC for my service, and unless I'm going to get it wirelessly from the city of Los Angeles in 10 years, those are going to be my only two choices. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying you have, on the internet, you have probably 8 to 10 choices.
Well,
I
have the choice of DSL over SBC, or I have a choice of a cable modem over Adelphia.
Right,
those are two choices. And
let's assume that either one. You only have one broadband connection. You can either get it from SBC, who gives you your phone line over a pair of copper wires,
right.
Or you have over your internet connection. You have probably 8 different choices of providers to give you phone service. You can choose a cheapy plan for $19 a month, where you get all local calling, because maybe you make only local calls.
Who am I getting this service from?
Go look up online VoIP providers. I mean, AOL is now offering me all you can eat local calling for $19 a month.
Oh, so what you're saying is that I need to get my broadband. Maybe I've not made it clear enough. I can only get my broadband internet connectivity as such from SBC or Adelphia. And after I've done that, then if I want to pay Vonage or someone else to provide my phone service, I can do that.
Yeah, what were you asking?
Well, I was asking whether...
About DSL?
Well,
I mean about broadband? You only have two choices?
I have only two choices for broadband.
Oh, okay. I thought you said phone service.
No, no.
Yeah, well, right now, until you have a wireless option, those are your two choices.
And you don't feel that might be anti-competitive?
You know what? What are you going to do? You're going to go steal money from somebody and make... You're going to go take somebody to the bank, put a gun to their head and say, loan this other company $50 billion to build another network, or are you going to have the government build it for you?
In Philadelphia, the government of Philadelphia is setting up a nonprofit corporation called Wireless Philadelphia.
Yep.
They're going to build and maintain a wireless Wi-Fi network, which they say will be universal in the city, and then they're going to allow any number of ISPs, from little ones to big ones, to provide the service over that. In other words, they're going to unbundle that capability to anyone who wants it.
They're not unbundling it. They're putting a wireless network together,
right.
And any ISP can use it.
Right.
And more power to them.
And you're saying you don't have any problem with that.
No, would I make that decision as a local government official? Not necessarily, because I don't necessarily think it's a good idea.
Right.
But in terms of wireless, when you have such a low barrier to entry,
right.
It's low cost. Of course, they're going to do. And I hope San Francisco, does it as well, so that every time I walk to a park or I go downtown, I have wireless access. There's no question. I think that helps competition because it helps drop the prices of the incumbents, and the cable companies for what they're offering.
So in fact, you believe that municipal broadband is a good idea because it provides competition to the would be a duopoly of wired internet access from the phone companies and the cable companies.
I'm not going to say it's a good idea or a bad idea.
But you say it's politically, if entities want to do it, you don't see any legal or regulatory impediments why they can't.
There should not be any legal or regulatory impediments. There should be some economic questions about whether or not they're making a good investment. Because anytime you have the government making the investment in a technology, are they going to be able to keep up with technological changes? Or are those customers in that area going to be able to have access to higher service or better quality service if you got this basically a cheap municipal system that was put in place? I mean, the next time there's an economic downturn and they can't get a bond measure passed to do the upgrades, you may have cut out a Verizon or somebody else from coming into that area because they can't compete with subsidized bonds in terms of borrowing money to invest in a network. Have you actually hurt consumers? I don't know. I wouldn't be in a position to make that call. I wouldn't certainly not prevent any municipality from attempting to do that because, this is a quality of life issue at this point.
Okay, so with that or without that municipal broadband, you believe that having a duopoly of wireline access, either through cable or phone companies, is going to lead to technological innovation, universal or close to it.
It's such a red herring.
Right.
Two is better than one.
Right.
Three is better than two.
All right.
Four is better than three.
The fact is,
you have investors out there that have spent billions and billions of dollars to build a second broadband pipe that's hardwired,
right.
The cable company. The question is, will there be a third? Will it be BPL? Wireless is? I don't know why you're downplaying the effectiveness of wireless because a whole lot.
No,
of
I wasn't.
People,
I wasn't downplaying it.
I mean, but a whole lot of people get their wireless off there. So you have three opportunities for broadband, and you have so many different wireless opportunities. You're going to have four and five as the technology changes.
Okay. Finally, say a little bit about the politics and the PUC. Has Governor Schwarzenegger made any appointments yet, and are those moving in the direction that you'd like to see?
Well, anything's better than what it was that last year. Well, we thankfully changed to commissioners who I think had very, very strong ideological views that more regulation is always better.
And they were replaced by whom?
One seat is still vacant.
Right.
The other seat was replaced by a Schwarzenegger appointee. Her name is Diane Grunick, and she just started a couple of months ago. And now, you know, absolutely, there's been a complete seat change in the politics of this commission.
Okay. Just give us one or two sentences on how you see how the internet's going to evolve and the content is going to be provided over it over the next 2 to 3 years as you expect things to come over your desk there at the PUC.
I expect there to be tremendous innovation at both the edges and at the core of networks. I mean, I think you're seeing tremendous amount of competitive pressure at both the providers of the broadband networks like SBC and Verizon and Comcast and Time Warner, as well as the edge providers that are thinking up brand new things every day, the Vonages and the 8x8s, you know, and the Ciscos and the, you know, the AOLs. So I think there's what we have to watch for is making sure that you know, the concept of internet freedom is embedded in our future regulatory policies.
So, and when you say internet freedom, what do you mean?
It means that nobody can block ports that stops me from getting to a VoIP provider, or nobody can tell me I have to buy my local phone service from SBC if I want to have DSL service. If I want to have SBC DSL and I want to use Vonage or another VoIP provider, I should be able to do that.
Okay.
So that's leaving the customer choice is the key to making this competitive market work.
Do you believe that the Telecommunications Act of 1996 ought to be rewritten?
Yes.
And maybe next time we can talk about your vision of what it ought to say when it is.
Might be easier to just scrap it, but yeah.
Okay, good. All right, I want to thank you very much for talking to us on California Politics today, and hopefully we'll be able to do this again at a shorter interval than the last time, and use some of these technologies that we're talking about to get your views out to an even wider audience even more easily.
Very good.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.